Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
Patti Smith has been creating, inventing for a long time now. From the days of punk rock until probably this morning, musician, poet, memoirist, the punk poet laureate, she's been called. But by now, she's more than that. Her 2010 memoir, Just Kids, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. Now she's out with a new book, Devotion, about the workings of creativity, inspiration, obsession, solitude. This hour on Point, Patti Smith on creativity and invention. You can join us on air or online with this conversation as always on What Stirs Your Creative Buzz. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Patti Smith, musician, artist, writer. Just Kids, about her long-ago relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, won the National Book Award in 2010. M-Train came out in 2015, was a New York Times bestseller. We talked with her about that. Patti Smith, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Hello. Nice to talk to you.
You too. It's always great to have you here. Thanks a lot for coming back today. It was fun reading the new book and reading what some of the people are writing about you as the new book comes out. Megan Volpert in popmatters.com, she says, Patti Smith is some messed up kind of saint, shrouded in the darkness of Gotham, hard-boiled and sharpshooting. On the other hand, she glides along the clouds of lapsed Catholicism, innocent and ethereal. Smith seems both closer to herself and to her God than most mere mortals. Do you feel like a lapsed, some kind of messed up saint any days these days, Patti?
Well, hardly a saint. I would agree with the messed up part. You know, I am at least messy. I am often a bit disheveled. But it was very nice what she said. But, you know, there's always the equalizers. The book has also been cited as claptrap. So I think that we just I look at all of these things that people say and just remember that what really defines you, whether it's positive or negative, is the work itself. So people would agree with that. But I still think it's really nice what she said and very well written.
It really was. Some messed up kind of saint for a punk rocker. Maybe that's the highest accolade. I'm not sure. But she's interesting how she picked up on your lapsed Catholicism. In the new book, you refer back to Simone Weil quite often. Intellectual, mystic, and all the rest. And it made me wonder, plus the fact that you're always tracking heroes down to their gravestones, about your relationship with Catholicism, with the mystic at this point. Has it grown more or less important in your life?
Well, I've never been Catholic. I was raised Jehovah Witness.
Yes.
But I was drawn to Catholicism basically aesthetically, because, of course, within the churches, and you go to Europe and you find within the Catholic Church Caravaggio's, Giotto, crucifixes carved by Michelangelo. So a lot of my most of my relationship with Catholicism is a particular interest in ritual and art. And an added thing is that I really like Pope Francis. But, you know, I haven't been part of an organized religion since I was 12, but I'm always attentive. You know, I always think I'm always grateful for being alive. I'm always thinking of our Creator and, you know, so I don't have any organized religion, but I move freely in any church. I'll go to a synagogue. I'll go to a mosque. I'll go to, you know, I'll pray in a field. But not in any didactic way.
Our creator, you said, I mean, creation is a subject of devotion, and you convey how, I mean, it's a book which is interesting. It's a meditation on creativity and invention. In the middle of it, there's a short story, and you help us see the pointers of how everyday life kind of fed you raw material that ends up in this story. Along the way, you're visiting graves, the grave of Camus, the grave of Simone Weil. What takes you to gravestones of the inventors, the creatives that you admire?
Well, I think the first grave that I visited was Arthur Rimbaud's when I was very young, maybe 22, in Charville. Mm-hmm. And I have visited many, many graves, the Brontes, Sylvia Plath, Dag Hammarskjöld. I couldn't even begin to count them. And I like visiting the graves of people that I admire and that I've learned from. It's a nice way to thank them within proximity. I know that, it's perhaps there's something ritualistic about it, but mm-hmm. I find it very comforting. You know, I never got to know Brancusi or Jean Genet, mm-hmm. but I visited their resting place and thank them. Sometimes I'll read, sometimes I'll leave them some type of talisman, often take a photograph. But it also takes me on many adventures because I usually travel alone and I'm not the vacationer type of person. So I have a mission, and that mission will take me to very unexpected places.
The Camus family invited you over in the story that you tell in this book, the non-fiction part of it. And you say that you rarely visit people's homes because it just gets too involved. I'd rather be in the hotel where things are sort of clean and not too complicated. But in this case, you went. What did you find?
Well, first of all, it's basically why I don't like to visit people's homes is just because I'm sort of restless. I feel confined. I'm kind of messy. I don't know. I just feel a bit confined, mm-hmm. no matter how nice everybody is. But in visiting them, it was a way to visit Camus. I saw his books there. They were very kind to me. Nothing was expected of me. I could come and go as I please. He was buried very close there, and I always wanted to go. And I did have some relationship with the family because I sang for Camus. I wrote pieces. I participated in a documentary with them. And so I had some relationship with them. But what I found was a sense of him and his family and a sense of why he chose this place in southern France to write and to and just to be alone or be with his family for solitude, because it seemed quite like Algeria there. He was born and raised mm-hmm. as a young fella in Algeria.
When it was a French colony. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some of the landscape, just the way the landscape, the scruffiness, the sort of, it almost looked like a fertile desert. Mm. It just brought to mind pictures I've seen of Algeria. So I think that there was a certain nostalgia for him being in this place. And coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, he was working on his last book, The First Man, there in the room that I was lucky enough to sleep in. And this book goes back to his childhood in Algeria. So I think that the landscape there was comforting and also inspiring to him.
It was in his valise, this manuscript, when he died in the
yes.
auto accident. You visited the villa that I guess the family bought with the Nobel Prize.
He bought it.
He bought it. Oh, okay, money. I didn't know the story of you singing for Camus. What do you mean by that? What was that?
Well, I sang on his behalf mm-hmm. in a documentary. But I mean, I sing for people. I sat at Genet's grave and sang him a little song. You know, that's how I look at things. I'll sing for them, you know, talk about things or just sit there quietly. you know, so maybe lay of some wildflowers or, you know, I find cemeteries quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, of course, a place of sorrow, but there are also a place of comfort for people. You know, one goes to visit mm-hmm. their mother or...
Mm-hmm. I do.
I visit my departed husband at the cemetery and you just talk about the kids. It's just a, it's one knows that they are, you know, somewhere, you know, on a journey within the air, you know, traveling back to God. Who knows where our people go, but you can just, it's almost symbolically feel them in this place. So I find them very comforting.
You're a creator, a lifelong creator. You've created a lot. When you're on your sojourns, are you consciously at some level, tell the truth, Patti Smith, are you consciously collecting material?
Well, I think we're, you know, one, yes. I mean, not it's consciously, unconsciously, mm-hmm. whether I like it or not, mm-hmm. Things often become, you know, sort of sacred fodder for one's work. Sometimes I just want to be left alone and not think about anything. I don't want to write. I don't want to take a photograph. I don't mm-hmm. want to think of anything. But the mind, that's why the first section is called How the Mind Works,
mm-hmm.
because our mind is like a little computer. It's taking all of these impulses and creating despite ourselves.
We're going to come back and look at Patti Smith's telling of how the mind works when it comes to creativity. She writes about it in her new book, Devotion. You can join us this hour. Are you ready to talk creativity with Patti Smith? Is she exhibit A for you, the coolest role model? And what gets you in the groove to create, to let loose, tap a vein, hear the music inside? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Patti Smith, please stand by there in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
There was washed up a smiling angel. With ever blind hair now, I was looking for you. How you gone, gone?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Patti Smith, musician, writer, poet, godmother of punk, about creativity and invention and her new book, Devotion. Redondo Beach there from her famous 1975 album, Forces, a long time ago, and she still very much at it. You can join us this hour. Are you ready to talk creativity with Madam Smith? And do you, like Patti Smith, let yourself go to create? Let yourself roll with obsessions, fixations? Is creativity easier when you're younger? When you're older? When you're older, do you just put it out there? Patti Smith, still putting it out there. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I want to roll the tape way back. 1972, you were 26 years old, Patti. Just to have the sound of the span of your years in our minds as we think about a lifetime of creativity. This was a TV documentary, West Side Stories by Tristram Powell, following a young Patti Smith as she reflects on her New York City experiences. And here she is. This was 1972 this came out, describing the image of New York she'd crafted in her mind before she got there, based on representations she'd seen from artists like de Kooning and Jackson Pollock and Frantz Kline.
The way I thought of New York in my head
wasn't any glitter or big buildings or promise of anything. To me, it was a slash of like dirty grayish pink, you know, like representing the side of a building. And then Jackson Pollock, if he did a painting of New York, it was filled with, you know, all that nervous energy, you know, all that. So my view of New York was abstract, but it was abstract. It was dirty abstract. It wasn't abstract in the clouds. It was abstract in the street.
Patti Smith in 1972. Patti, when you listen to that now and think about creativity over time, is what you're writing about in Devotion, is it the same process, whether you're 26 there or somewhat beyond that now?
Well, excuse me, I wasn't quite 26, I don't think.
Oh,
but,
forgive me.
It doesn't matter. I was a little younger.
Younger than that, even. Okay.
Well, I to me, the creative process for me, because I'm multi-disciplined, mm-hmm. is continual. It's always been continual. Mm-hmm. When I came to New York, I wanted to be a painter and a poet. I never thought of being a performer, of being a singer. And so all of my creative energies and all of my process went into drawing, studying art, reading poetry, writing poetry, mm-hmm. performing poetry. I've always been working. I've been writing stories since I was 7. I've never wanted to be anything else except with any real passion except a writer or an artist. And because I'm always – my mind is always working. It's always making up stories. It's always reinventing. If I go to the opera, I'm reinventing it. If I see a movie, I'm changing the ending. My mind is always at work.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of that work, the texture of it, or the sources of inspiration, or the way you see them evolving over time?
Well, I think that over time, one thing I learned was to rein things in and discipline myself, finish things, use my time wisely, especially when I got married in 1980 and had children.
Yeah.
I had to set aside a special time, say 5 in the morning till 8 in the morning, when I could write and have some solitude. And that was my time. So I really had to discipline myself and really focus. And that was a very good exercise, 16 years of discipline, which now that I can do anything I want, I'm pretty free. I still go back to that sense of discipline.
Here's the very top of Patti Smith's new book, Devotion, about creativity, inspiration, invention. She writes, "Inspiration is the unforeseen quantity, the muse that assails at the hidden hour. The arrows fly, and one is unaware of being struck, and that a host of unrelated catalysts have joined clandestinely to form a system of its own, rendering one with the vibrations of an incurable disease, a burning imagination at once unholy and divine." Do you feel the inspiration when it hits, or is it just absorbed and recognized later?
Well, it's not all inspiration. A lot of it is manual labor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I mean, what I was saying, I was trying to map out in the beginning of the book is that we can be of two minds, that when you think of creating, one always thinks, well, you're going to create something beautiful. But the mind will, you know, the same mind that creates something beautiful will also turn on that beauty and destroy it. It's part of the creative process is also a destructive process and then a regenerative process.
Here you share with us as sort of bits, impressions, moments hit your screen that you later turn into a story that we read in the middle of Devotion, about a young skater who gets involved with an older man and the drama that ensues there. It's coming around in a way to the same question, but do you know those bits, the bits that will last when they arrive? Do you look back over recent days? Are you scribbling in notebooks?
Not necessarily. I mean, this is a unique book. It's not a book mm-hmm. that I would sit down to write. I was commissioned to give a speech at Yale about the process of writing and then to expand it into a little book. And I'm not an essay writer, and I read many pieces about writing, Margarita Duras or Virginia Woolf. Many, many people have written about writing. So I wanted to approach it in a different way. And when I was in Paris, I saw accidentally, totally accidentally, how to approach it. I simultaneously wrote a little novella or short story as I was keeping a diary of the things I was doing, my comings and goings in Paris. And right in front of me, like I say, like as if the story is a crime, I had all this Fersenic evidence of how the crime was committed. And some of it was, you know, some very obvious things, and other things like a plate of a round, perfectly round plate of ham and eggs became a perfectly round skating pond. You know, these things aren't planned. They're just simultaneous impulses. And I would never think that I would use a plate of eggs in a short story, abstract it and use it again. But then there's other things that are almost like poetry, which I write down that I think, ah, that's a good line, and I will use that line. It's such a mix of different impulses. Some of them very controlled, some uncontrolled.
Patti Smith in a Paris hotel room, struggling to stay awake, opens a biography of Simone Weil at random. Nods off, picks it up in a new section in the same room. She's watching competitive skating on TV, and a 16-year-old Russian comes out, steps onto the ice. She writes, as if nothing else exists, wins. Her triumph over the others brings me to tears. And then she writes, in my sleep, genius combines, regenerates. Simone's determined, heart-shaped face merges with the face of the young Russian figure skater. And the next thing you know, we're reading a novella, a short story in the middle of this, which puts all of that to work, along with a very round plate of ham and eggs. Patti Smith's new book is Devotion. Mary joins us from Pewaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. So good to be able to talk to Patti Smith. Thank you so much for everything you've done in music.
Thank you.
To me, you're an icon. Bought horses back in the day. You're on my bucket list. I don't know why I didn't see you here in Milwaukee. 6 months ago, you were here, and I read the reviews, I read M-Train, I saw you on Tavis Smiley, basically called in because I was just excited to hear that you're actually going to be on. And you're very deep, very intelligent, and you send a message. So basically this is just accolades to thank you for what you've done.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate your call from Wisconsin. One more from San Francisco. Dave, Diamond Dave is calling. Hi, Dave. You're on the air with Patti Smith.
Hey, Patti. You and
hello,
I
go Dave.
Way back, long before punk rock. They said they introduced you as a punk rocker. Well, you go way, way back before that. And I'm thinking about your connection with Bob Dylan, the very young Bob Dylan. That was about 1962 or 3, is that right?
Well, I was a teenager in high school, and first saw Bob Dylan singing with Joan Baez and then got his records. But, of course, I didn't know him. I was just a teenager. But it was a life-changing event to have Bob Dylan in my life because for his social conscience, for being anti-war, being concerned about the environment, his sense of poetry. And then Hallie broke everything apart, kicked through a few walls, and I love that even more. So, yes, I have followed Bob Dylan for a long time.
Isn't it true? Isn't it true that he picked, when he got the Nobel Prize for literature, he picked you to speak up for him? He also eventually, tell me if I'm right or wrong, he also eventually did his Nobel Prize speech, which I'm so sure you heard, and it was amazing. What did you think? It was amazing, wasn't it? Well, here we are talking about Moby Dick. Here we are talking about All Quiet on the Western Front. Here we are talking about Odyssey. Shoot, here he is, and just dropping it down And it's an amazing speech. What do you think?
Yes, I thought it was beautiful. And Bob, of course, is very well read, filled with wondrous references. And I know that it was quite meaningful for him to receive the prize. I did not go to speak for Bob Dylan. I went, actually, I was asked to sing a song before, I mean, during the ceremony. Mm-hmm. So I chose Hard Rain's Going to Fall. But I did not speak, but I did sing. So I did my best to bring my love and devotion for him with me.
We're talking with Patti Smith. Her new book is Devotion, about creativity and invention. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Caroline in Rutland, Vermont, you're on with Patti Smith. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. Hello, Patti.
Hello.
I had a couple of your songs stand out to me. Gung Ho and Gandhi. The process and how you were able to, it's almost operatic in the way that you approach their biographies. And I know you didn't meet Gandhi, or maybe you've traveled to India, but how were you able to devote and regenerate and transcend beautiful work, just beautiful work, two of my all-time favorite pieces.
Thank you.
Of yours.
Well, in terms of process, what I did is I was studying both Ho Chi Minh and Gandhi simultaneously. And I read several biographies. I read their own words. I read books, most importantly, their own words, and contemplated deeply both of these men. And we went into the studio, and it's interesting that you should pick these two songs, because we went into the studio and I didn't have words for each of them. They were sort of musical fields, and I do this on every album, but on that album I did it twice. And the band,
you show up with kind of a blank slate and just readiness, but not words.
Improvised. Mm-hmm. And both of them are improvised pieces. And in improvising, you have to channel, because there's a lot of, you have no words, so you have to channel all within you, all that you know and all that you can project about your subject. And that's how I was able to reach a certain point, you know, a very far away point. It's like, you know, you think of Coltrane going off on a solo. He goes mm-hmm. as far as he can to God, and then he comes back. And that's the same with the improvisation.
You sang there, I had a dream, you. Mr. King, if you'll beg my pardon. I was trespassing a sacred garden, and the blossoms fell, and they dropped like candy. And nature cried, Gandhi, Gandhi.
Yes. It just came to me. It was actually, these are very sacred moments to me in the studio, because I labored for, you know, you could labor for weeks or months on the lyrics to a song. Mm-hmm. And then you go and when you go under the gun into the studio to improvise, you're right there in the moment. And that's something that we've always done since the very first record, Birdland, Land, Radio Ethiopia, Radio Baghdad, Memento Mori. There's always a song, Constantine's Dream. All of these songs are improvised in the studio.
What's the make it to the record ratio with those improvisations? Are you so
They're
focused?
Essential.
That, I mean, no, but do
They're
they
essential.
Do six go by the wayside for every one that comes together, or are you so focused that in that moment it happens and you press it?
You can't do six. You know, there mm-hmm. some of them are 14 minutes long. Mm-hmm. I might do two. Mm-hmm. Perhaps three, but no more than that. And usually I know which one. Sometimes it's the first ones. You just know. You just know that you've said and you've reached a certain point. Because also, if you do it too much, you can get like a migraine. It's such deep concentration. So, you know, it's usually once or twice.
Spontaneous, improvised, one strand of Patti Smith's creativity. They're in Gandhi and Gung Ho and others. Patti Smith's new book is all about creativity and invention. It's called Devotion. She's with us from New York this hour. This is Dancing Barefoot from 1979, Wave. You can join us. Is creativity easier when you're younger, when you're older? What's your path to creativity? What's your question for Patti Smith on life, art, our world, her world? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Patti Smith, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Patti Smith, musician, writer, poet, godmother of punk. She's been called about creativity and invention. Her new book is Devotion, and that is its subject. Paths That Cross There from her 1988 album Dream of Life. Patti Smith joins us from New York, and you can join us as well. What's your question for Patti Smith now, 2017, looking out on the world? On your own path toward creativity, we're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Patti, lots of people responding online. Casey writes, I've spent my entire adult life trying to create visual art in the same passionate, vivacious, and spiritual way that Patti Smith speaks and moves with her music. Ellen joins us from Belfast, Maine. Ellen, you're on the air with Patti Smith. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Patti. This is Ellen Sander. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Great to talk to you. So I enjoy your records, and I love Just Kids. I can't wait to read this book and share it with my writing group. I want to talk to you about your recordings for a minute, because I would be really interested in hearing a spoken word record of you, that where the poetry is really up front, and if there's music, it's not formulated like a song. And I'm wondering how you feel about the difference between being performance poet fronting a band and doing spoken word.
Well, a lot performing to me always has the same motivation, and that's communicating with the people there. I don't like singing at people or reading at people. I like to feel that, you know, we're of a common mind. So in that sense, it's not altogether different except for the obvious sonically. And the creation of poetry and lyrics is very different, though. When I'm writing the lyrics to a song, I have the responsibility to the musician who's written the music and also to the fact that it will be sung to the people, and it has to be communicative to the people. And when I'm writing a poem, I'm not thinking of anyone. I'm not thinking of any kind of responsibility except for the poem itself. And so they come from sort of a different mindset. And I can't remember the first part of the question.
Well, it's basically whether you're interested in performing just spoken word without the music background.
Well, I do a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I perform all over. I just did a poetry. I read poetry and did a few acoustic songs in Mexico City in a park for 5,000 people reading poetry. And I often do that. It's just I like to mix them because I think since my very first reading, because I tend to get restless listening mm-hmm. to a lot of poetry read, and I get restless reading, just continually reading. So I like to break it up with telling stories or singing little songs. But in terms of recording poetry, I've recorded some. I'm working on another project. But I've also done two audio books of M-Train and Just Kids, and I really have enjoyed doing that because, again, you're projecting to the listener.
I have a little bit of you reading from your poem. This is all the way back again, 1975. This is Oath, which, of course, later got talking about mixing things. It got brought into Gloria, your reinvention of the original Van Morrison song. But here's the poem that ended up in the song, a little bit of Patti Smith reading Oath in 1975.
Christ died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Melting in a pot of thieves, wild card up my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own. They belong to me.
How did that end up in Gloria? Was it...
I think that particular... That might have been quite early, because mm-hmm. I already recorded Gloria in 75, so mm-hmm. it's probably much earlier reading. But how it got... I read that poem. I wrote that poem when I was about 20, mm-hmm. and then I performed it at St. Mark's Church as a poem in 1971. And then when I started working with Lenny Kaye and my pianist, Richard Soul, I got more and more interested in performing poetry with like sort of a drone behind me or just a couple chords. So as I was working on that poem, I said, why don't we do that on top of like a three-chord song? And I think it was Lenny who suggested Gloria as a possibility of a good three-chord song. Mm. And so I listened to, you know, The Shadows of Night and Them and all the different versions of Gloria. And so I just decided to merge the poem and just go into Gloria because I thought mm-hmm. that the, you know, just something about the power of Gloria. And I like the idea that it's starts out with you know, Jesus died and goes into Gloria. It seemed
it
intrigued me, but it was really Alan Lanier, who was the keyboard player of the Blue Oyster Cult. We had a relationship at the time, and I used to perform the poem quite aggressively. And when I was recording it with John Cale, it was Alan who suggested that I back off a little and sort of bring it a little bit more slinky mm-hmm. and not so aggressively, mm-hmm. More seductively. Mm-hmm. And so I did, and it was very good advice.
In the new book, Devotion, I mean, you take us right at nearly the end to the heart of what the task is. You say, what is the task? To compose a work that communicates on several levels, as in a parable, devoid of the stain of cleverness. And you say, what is the dream? To write something fine that would be better than I am and that would justify my trials and indiscretions. To offer proof through a scramble of words that God exists. Hold the God piece for a second. The stain of cleverness, what is it you're looking to avoid there?
Well, you know, being snarky, mm-hmm. ironic, which isn't my style, but, you know, sometimes you have to, or being, too clever in plays of words or, mm-hmm. you know, just to get involved in, one's in their own world, but you can get so deeply involved in your own world that you can become too clever, which, you know, when I see that, I try to unravel it or discard it. But the idea is that to do something that is higher than that, you know, no matter what it is, whether it's a memoir or anything, it's mm-hmm. so easy to be snarky. It's so easy to be vindictive.
Yeah.
It's so easy to be glib. And it's just, it's something I really try to avoid.
And the dream to try and write something that would justify my trials and indiscretions. Sounds Catholic.
Well, I think indiscretion is more, not so much doing something wrong, but I got my own version of that, you know, and it might be as simple as, you know, being more involved in my work sometimes than my fellow human beings or, you know, my friends or even my family because I'm very work-centric. And, you know, I spend probably the lion's share of my life, you know, working and in tandem with being a mother. Of course, I would, you know, interrupt anything I do if my children need me. But, you know, I'm very work-centric. And so one would hope that it's not to no avail. It's not about fame or fortune or any of that stuff. It's to actually hopefully add to the canon of work that inspires people, of endurable work. And that's always the dream, to do something that can be added to the canon of Pinocchio, you know, Moby Dick, or, you know, A Child's Garden of Verses, whatever it might be.
Robert Louis Stevenson, and to offer proof you write through a scramble of words that God exists. What does that mean? Not Jehovah's Witness, not a Catholic, and nevertheless.
Oh, it's just really, you know, when you think of you're working from the highest. I don't know. I don't like really trying to analyze or break down everything I say. I mean, it's just, you know, we're maybe at some point I'm still working on that. You're just trying to go, whether it's within an improvisation or a performance or writing a poem, you're trying to go as high or as deep as you can to get to that pool of universal knowledge that, you know, that that some people might call God, higher consciousness. So it's, you know, something I could probably talk about for hours or not at all.
I think we get it.
Hopefully.
Jane in Lake Placid, New York. Thank you for calling, Jane.
Hi, I'm so honored, Patti Smith, to be in the conversation with you. I saw you at Carnegie Hall when you were sending aid to Tibet several years ago in the winter. And I love Just Kids, and I just know when you write, there's a lot of love in it because of what you put in Just Kids. My question is, I do a little writing, I do a little poetry, and I am 74, and I'm trying to justify my next 20 years by writing. And I wanted to ask you the burden and the heavy barrier that I have about that, which is most of what I want to say either comes from love or having been rejected. And I know you go much wider and much higher. How does something like tenderness and love and the real specifics, I know you mentioned earlier this morning, the day in the talk, that you stay away from everything that isn't going to lead to something higher. But there is a objective correlative. There is something there in relationships that are so tender. And it seems to me it's a little bit forbidding because I don't want to reveal private things. And so what I'm asking you is, when it comes to really getting into poetry's base, that it occurred in your life, how do you have the bravery and the courage to and somehow describe what you feel you want to express, but without breaking any bonds of confidentiality?
Well, that's always that's a continuing struggle for artists or writers, sometimes because of the eccentricity, the egocentric aspect of the artist or the writer, or they don't really always think about consequences, or they feel that their work justifies what the consequences might be. That's a personal, you know, that's a very personal choice. I mean, I don't find anything wrong with self-censoring myself. I sometimes will censor myself just in terms of the feelings of others. When I was younger, I wasn't so self-censoring, and sometimes I wasn't concerned how something I might write or say would affect a person. But when I worked on Just Kids, every single person I wrote about, whether I liked them or not, whether they had been cruel to me or nice to me, I tried to think of them first as a human being and try to represent them well. And I think if this is a deep concern of yours, move into fiction and keep, you know what you want to say, but there's so many things you can do. Change their genders, change the time period. You know, if it's a contemporary story, make it in the 19th century. I mean, there's ways that you can take personal experience and reinvent it. But it's very hard for a writer to completely divest himself from all of the things that make him who he is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Patty, you've been creating over decades now. Do different times, in your case, lead to different kinds or qualities of creativity? We're in a particular time right now.
I think that it's just a matter of, for instance, if I'm traveling, with the band, it's very hard to write when you're on the road. You don't have enough time or solitude. And so I take my Polaroid camera and I tend to take more photographs when I'm on the road because I'll just go off by myself for an hour and take a few shots of something. It could be a piece of sculpture. It could be a gravesite. It could be an empty street. But I'm always doing something. You know, if I'm in a cafe, I might suddenly feel moved to write a poem. Or walking down the street, a little song comes into my head. There, I have a sort of a disciplinary way of writing in the morning. But other than that, it might pop out any time.
Patty Smith writes about creativity and invention and gives us a new novella, short story, right in the middle of it, in her new book, Devotion. Patty, it's always wonderful talking with you. Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Patty Smith, her new book is Devotion. It was Because the Night behind us right here, 1978, best-known single, performed with the Patty Smith Group off the 78 album Easter, written with Bruce Springsteen. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.